Peter Davison, who I understand plays doctors and lawyers and various other characters. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
I always wondered if you were a manifestation on PBS or but now I actually know that you're corporeal. You're here in the you're here.
I have the same feeling myself sometimes.
Oh, you do. How do you distinguish between that? I mean, when you go and perform a role, I mean, are you sort of in a kind of fugue state? Do you know who you are when you're playing it? Do you summon some sort of like abstruse emotional energy?
No, what happens is with me, it's a kind of form of, it has to be sometimes very quick osmosis. You know, you kind of start off with a blank page, and as you get familiar with the script, the character kind of is joined to you. It's sort of barnacles almost.
Oh, yeah. I see Tristan off your shoulder right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And you do start, depending on the parts you play, you bring them home with you sometimes.
Yeah.
So if you are playing a bit of a psychotic character, it can mean trouble at home.
But you haven't really played much in the psychotic characters.
I think that's a good thing.
I mean, you're too nice a guy? Or have you had a great desire to chew the scenery like that?
You know, every so often, I have made a career of playing fairly nice guys.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy doing that. But
yeah, you are.
Every so often.
Very nice doing that.
Thank you very much. But every so often you just get a kind of feeling you just want to be kind of play a nasty character.
Yeah.
And fortunately, usually when those feelings have come about, one comes along that you like and you'll accept it. I played a bit of a bad guy recently in an episode of Lewis, which is a British sort of detective series.
Oh, really? How evil were you for this?
I was pretty nasty, actually. I was very much of a sort of...
You push ladies down the stairs?
I kill people.
You kill people?
Yeah, and make them disappear. Okay. But in a nice and charming, smiley way.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to ask you about one of the reasons why you're here, Doctor Who, and I'm going to try to do it through a few unusual angles. There's one thing I have noticed. Like, I know that when Tom Baker left, he took his boots with him. And during the early run of Doctor Who, you're wearing what I guess is your own sneakers. Is that true? Is that safe to say? Or did the BBC actually allow you your own? Did they actually make shoes for you? Or did you have to sort of come in with your own
footwear? You have proper costume fittings, and people sit down for long periods of time and discuss what you're going to wear.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they were pretty much off-the-peg shoes, but the BBC did pay for them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the rest of the outfit...
So you can wear them home.
No, because they wouldn't trust you to bring them back in the morning. So
oh, really?
No.
Well, I mean, what input did you have into the design of, like, the Doctor's costume? And how was it like for you to, you know, I mean, how strict were they? I know you've said in other interviews that there were some bizarre union restrictions in which lights went out at 10 or something like that.
Oh, the whole thing in those days was a very complex procedure. I mean, I had input into my outfit, but it was very much not in specifics. The producer said we're looking for something that is more youthful and, you know, slightly kind of more energetic and sportier.
Yeah, cricket says youthful.
And I thought cricket fitted the bill exactly, so I suggested the idea of a cricket outfit.
Yeah.
If I'm honest with you, I would have chosen a more off-the-peg look. It was a bit too designer for me.
Yeah.
Because the idea with the TARDIS is a room somewhere in the depths of the TARDIS in which is a whole range of clothes, and when the Doctor regenerates, he simply goes into the room and he goes, I'll have this bit, this one here, I'll try this on here, and he comes out with a kind of thrown together outfit.
Yes.
With my outfit, it just seemed like it probably wasn't hanging around on a peg, which is what I didn't like about it. On the other hand, I thought it was had a very good style to it. I was very happy with it in the end.
Yeah. You showed off your cricket skills in Black Orchid. What were your cricketing skills before that? Or was that pure acting?
No, it wasn't. I'm not bad at cricket.
Really?
Compared to most actors, who are pretty rubbish.
You're not going to name names.
I could actually, but I won't. But in one of the scenes there, you can clearly see me actually bowl somebody out.
Yeah.
Which I was very fortunate they managed to get in shot.
Yeah.
So I wasn't bad. I was very happy to do that.
Well, while we're talking about physicality, I have to ask because... So I watched a good deal of the Doctor Who run yet again after many, many years that you did. And the one thing I noticed is that you kept your hands in your pocket or behind your back quite a bit.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you're just kind of a spastic guy or a guy who gesticulates, if this was an effort to try to prevent you from doing that on camera. Because, I mean, sometimes you have your hands in their pocket, they're like clenched in there, like you know your hands are going to go free. So what of this?
Well, I don't know where it first came out. I think probably it just came out of, I was stuck in, I played a role before before Doctor Who in All Creatures Great and Small,
called
Tristan.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, now Tristan, I think, is described as forever having his hands in his pocket. So that became such a kind of...
The Davison crutch?
Yes, a Davison crutch, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think it just carried on a bit, and probably it shouldn't have done. On the other hand, I have to say, you know, I did a series about 3 or 4 years ago in which Roger Daltrey, you know, of The Who, played a part.
Uh-huh.
And we were having this scene together in the pub. He'd do a shot on him, and he was sort of doing his lines and talking to me. And then we'd do another shot, another angle, and the continuity person would keep coming up to him and going, Roger, you raised your hand in the air on this shot, and you put your hand on the drink in this shot, then you put your hand in your pocket on that shot.
Yeah.
And he got into such a terrible state. And nothing was ever said to me. And he said to me, you know, why? How come you're so good at this?
Yes.
And I said, because I never do anything with my hands at all.
Yeah.
It's a great advantage. In a way, it's a great advantage to put your hands in your pockets, because no one comes up to you and says, you did this with this hand here. I think I probably overdid it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how rigid were the script supervisors or continuity during the BBC days in the 80s and the 90s? Mm. Were they really as anal as they are now, or what?
You know, in my experience, and I've had relatively tiny experience in film, but I, in television, they're absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
You know, you do get mistakes, but I've seen more mistakes in movies, in editing and things of people's positions and hands and props and which hand they held things up in than I have done in television.
Yes.
They're pretty good in television. And of course, maybe it's something to do with the fact that the actors in television are doing a lot of things, and they're fairly disciplined, I think, TV actors. And maybe film actors somehow, shall we say, maybe less disciplined, maybe more inspirational, maybe more original in some areas, but less disciplined.
Yes.
And I certainly notice more mistakes watching the average film than I do in watching TV.
So I have to ask you, we talked of cricket beforehand.
Yeah.
I had heard some sort of rumor that you were pursuing a career as a pop singer roughly around the time of All Creatures Great and Small, and even while you were playing Doctor Who.
Oh, well, where did you hear that?
I've had my sources, and I was hoping to go ahead and, before they continue on the internet, to actually get the hard journalistic truth.
Well,
did you have pop singer aspirations?
I did have it. Well, I've always written songs.
Oh, you do?
You see, yeah. And
there are loads of tapes hidden in your basement?
Loads of tapes hidden. I still have a little mini studio in my house. Yeah. And I still do stuff, but I think I've rather given up the idea of becoming a pop idol.
Record?
I do still record stuff. And there was a time, I suppose it was about that time, where I thought, you know, it'd be really good to just get a band together and not use my name. I didn't want to try and sell it as Peter Davison doing it. So I just get a band, and then just get some songs together and just see what happened with them.
Yeah.
If one wasn't pushing it from a point of view of, because I think that's a kiss of death, actors saying they're in a band.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to do it from a tiny different angle. But,
or in the case of Doctor Who, Doctor in Distress is disastrous. Yeah.
Absolutely. But it came to grief, you know, for a bizarre reason musicians have a completely different lifestyle to actors. It seems like they would be very close, but we would do things like we would call a rehearsal session 7 o'clock in the evening. So I'd be there at 7 o'clock. So just rehearsal, 7 o'clock in the evening, and then at about 11 p.m. the bass player would turn up. Then at about 1 o'clock in the morning, the lead guitarist would turn up, and about 2:30, we'd actually get enough people there to actually start rehearsing. By which time, it wasn't long before dawn was breaking, and I was exhausted because I'm not used to it. Like, musicians just have this idea, you know, let's just do a little bit of jamming for a couple of hours, and then let's get down to it. So I realized, really, although I loved doing it, I didn't have the mentality of a musician, of a band member.
Yeah.
I was a bit too a conformist even for that. I thought actors were fairly unconformist.
Well, like a very peculiar practice, I know you had basically one writer and one director through a good chunk of the run. Do you prefer that kind of constancy as an actor, as a performer, that actually is better for you? Do you sort of get nervous if there's a constant shuffle of directors? Or?
It depends on what it is. You know, I've done a couple of series where the same director has directed all the episodes.
Yeah.
I did a series called Very Peculiar Practice, one director. All Creatures, Great and Small, Last Detective. You're right, we had different directors coming in, actually, for most of the episodes. But you still have the same crew coming on every week, so you have a certain amount of consistency. It's horses for courses.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on series television. I think it's quite good to get varied directors in because it just gives a different spark,
yes,
different style to the episode. Whereas if you're doing a serial, I think it's important to have at the most two directors, mm-hmm, ideally one director,
yeah,
because they know exactly what they're doing.
Speaking of directors, I'm hoping you might be able to provide some light on this rumor involving Peter Grimwade, director of Earthshock, yeah, and Kinda. The story goes, at least promulgated by Eric Sayward, that he actually snubbed John Nathan Turner, didn't invite him to a party, and then Peter Grimwade eventually was just doing writing for the show. Do you have any insight as to why he stopped directing? Because he was really good.
I think Peter was very talented. I didn't think he was that great a director, really. Huh. As far as the actors were concerned, uh-huh, I think he probably had good
more
ideas.
The visual director.
I probably undervalued him, to be honest with you. I didn't have any say in whether he did or not, did any more or not. But he didn't kind of inspire you with great confidence about what he was doing.
Really?
As a director. Although I think he was a very talented writer.
Time Flight?
What? Time Flight was unfortunate, you see, because Time Flight, I think, could have been done very well, but we had no money.
Yeah.
The sets were probably the most dreadful sets, yeah, that Doctor Who has ever had to put up with. And we literally shot Britain, you know, England before humans.
Plus the scene. Exactly.
In Studio 8 of the BBC with a little model of Concorde,
yes,
sitting on the back of, and it was just,
and the color separation overlay as the airplane leaves
was
amazingly
catastrophically bad. Yeah. And you felt very frustrated by the fact that there was just no money. The monsters were lumps of polystyrene moving around the set. That whole thing was, the actual script itself wasn't bad, but the realization of it was hugely disappointing, I think.
So it seems to me, to make a good Who story, you really need to have good direction and good acting in order to sell the illusion. What do you do when you've got a guy like Paul Jericho delivering No Not the Mind Probe in absolutely horrendous delivery?
Yeah.
In The Five Doctors, No Not the Mind Probe, you know, which is a very famous incident.
I know.
How do you as an actor deal with this?
Well, I think you have to use your instinct and not do and not be led astray.
He doesn't
not be
exist.
Led astray by the director. I mean, sometimes I'm always very, very wary when I hear director, give me a bit more. Sort of, and you think, oh no, I'm sure that's not right. I'm sure it's not right. And I've learned now you have to make a decision as to whether you're going to trust the director or not. Who are you going to trust? Do you trust yourself more to the director? And sometimes it's a difficult thing to do.
Did anybody, though, say anything when he delivered the line that way? I mean, it's so remarkably bad.
You know, a lot of directors I've discovered barely even notice.
Really?
If they're visual directors,
yeah,
you can. I've worked with a lot of directors where I've said entirely the wrong line, stumbled over it, and then I hear the click going, okay, let's move on, great, let's move on. You go, no, hang on a minute, I said the wrong line. And they go, oh, did you? They don't notice.
Wow.
There's some directors that listen, and I love those directors that listen because they are what you might call actors' directors.
Yeah.
Who are really concerned with what you're giving as an actor, and then you trust them. And so if they say, that's fine, let's move on, you go, okay, that's fine. Other directors you know are just looking at the picture, they barely notice until they sit down. But you know, they would sit down in the cut and go, he said it like that, and we let him get away with it?
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, when you're on the floor and you hear someone say a line like, no, not the mind probe, you don't quite know how it's coming over. Upstairs, they should have known how it came over, and they should have said, let's go again. But I think there's panic, there's rush, there's not enough time to get the thing done. They think, oh, it'll be fine, and it's very often not.
Yeah. So which Who directors really did actually listen or pay attention to the lines and pay attention to the performances? Or were the conditions that you were making these serials just really, it was impossible to have that level of detail that it needed? Or maybe there was a certain advantage in this kind of almost live theater approach to doing television?
Mm. I... Not many directors, I would say. I'm not being awful about them, because, as you say, they were under tremendous pressure to get the thing done. If they didn't get those you touched on it earlier, if those scenes that were required weren't done by 10 o'clock, the lights went off.
Yeah.
And then there's a huge amount of trouble, because then you're behind. You have to knock scenes on into the next studio block.
Yeah.
You have to bring the set back. All sorts of disasters. I liked working with a director called Peter Moffat. I think he was an old style director. He wasn't particularly genned up on science fiction. In my time as Doctor Who, not until we got to Graham Harper did I think that we really worked with the director. And he was my love story.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
That we really hit in a director who was kind of attuned to what we were trying to do.
And went on to direct New Who as well.
Yeah, exactly. Subsequent to that, I worked with... you know, as you move on to more prestigious stuff, because in those days, although Doctor Who had a huge profile, although it was very successful in terms of being sold to the country, it wasn't thought of as being a prestige BBC show.
Yeah.
But as I moved on, I worked with other directors in different projects, and you suddenly realize this is what directing is about. These people are listening to what you're saying. And they will pick up on things that you haven't quite got right.
Yeah.
And they'll give you really good notes about things. There's not time for that in Doctor Who. And probably the directors themselves are not chosen to do that. They're chosen very often to be compliant to what Doctor Who requires.
Yes.
They're not really chosen to be, let's get the acting really perfect here. Yeah. They're just chosen because the producer or needs someone to just go... Get that done, let's move on to the next one.
Sure. So to get a sense of the calamitous production situation, I'm curious, I know you have complained about some of the stories, and this was one of the reasons, aside from the Patrick Troughton advice, don't do this beyond 3 years, for you leaving the series.
Mm-hmm.
When you were on Doctor Who, I mean, what kind of advance notice did you get when you got a script? I mean, how much of the season did you know plot in advance when you did this? Did you have any input into the stories? How did you work with Nathan Turin to say, well, look, you know, I'm not sure about this. What happened?
You had you knew about certain intentions. So I knew ahead of time about companions leaving and things like that. Didn't really know about anything about the stories until you were given the scripts, which is usually only effectively one ahead. So while you're making one, you'd be given the script to the next one.
Wow.
Never further ahead than that. So any input you had was only really the input you had during the rehearsal process.
Yeah.
So you might try and adjust certain things. With me, you know, I loved the idea that there was humor in Doctor Who. Not to the point at which it took away from the drama of it, but there should be humor. John Nathan Turner at the time was very anti-humor.
Yeah.
Because of, I think he had suffered at the hands of Tom and what he thought of as undergraduate humor.
Yeah. And he followed Graham Williams, which was very humor-based.
Yeah. So he wanted to cut back on all that. But I kind of wanted to, if you like, I was sort of in the intermediate phase. I wanted to have some fun stuff in it. So it was always a matter of trying to get stuff in the rehearsal process.
Yeah.
And try and get it through what they called the producer's run without John taking it out. So that's really the only input that I had. And I knew about intent. I knew when they were going to get rid of Matthew and when they were going to get rid of Sarah or Janet.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't really for... He came to me and he said that he wanted to get an American companion.
Yes.
And I didn't think this was a good idea because I didn't think that's why the Americans watched it. My sense was that what the Americans liked about it was that it was British.
Yes.
They weren't going to be, there weren't more Americans weren't going to watch because there was an American companion, especially if it turned out, as it did turn out, that the companion wasn't actually American.
Yes.
Which
yes.
didn't really help the cause.
There were other reasons to watch her too.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Which I know, I got
yeah, and not watch me in my regeneration,
Of course, you could have worn a bikini too,
That's true.
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to influence him in that regard. So I think my input was fairly small, and I knew that I wasn't, you know, being confrontational about it. You just try and wheedle some of your own thoughts into it.
So how do you prepare for a story if you're only working one story in advance? If you're trying to develop any kind of arc or development of the Doctor, you know, and you don't have that much to go with. How did you actually do that?
You can't. It's simply a kind of instinctive, a thing, and you look for new facets which might be helpful and might be useful, in just, you know, with the character of the Doctor, expanding it, and maybe they're there in a story and maybe they're not.
Yeah.
You know.
So the second series that you did,
yeah.
It becomes more concerned around the big monster that comes from the past. There's a lot of there's more screaming companions. There's some very dodgy costumes.
Yeah.
You know, did you protest any of this direction?
Or? I didn't. I mean, the reason, you know, you touched on the reason that I left. The reasons that I decided that I wasn't going to do any more than three was based on the second season, really, not really the third season.
Yeah.
I had to make a decision that far in advance.
Yeah.
So at the end of the second season, which I really wasn't that happy with, John said, you know, what about the fourth season?
Yeah.
And I said, no, I think probably I'm going to stick to just doing three.
Yeah.
Now, I was much happier with the third season.
Yes.
So I think probably it was still an awfully good idea to leave when I did.
Yeah.
But it was largely based on a slightly uncomfortable second season that I had, I think.
So if you were playing the Doctor with this sort of blind instinct, you know, were you pretty much wigging the character as you went along? Did you develop certain tics over the years that you would fall back on? I mean, how did this work?
Yeah. I think you did exactly. And maybe you mistake those for character.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you really didn't know what you were doing.
Well, you kind of know what you're doing because you have in your head what this man is like.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, you do kind of know. I mean, at the beginning, you're very much a blank sheet. Doctor Who is a difficult part, you know, because it's not like any other part. You can't go back and look at it and go, okay, he comes from this background, he's in this social, level.
He had a rough childhood.
Exactly. yeah. No, all these things is what you do with a character in an ordinary piece. But he, of course, is a 750-year-old Time Lord from Gallifrey. So you're left with this sort of, just make something of it yourself, you know. And so you do rely on I suppose, certain sort of tics and tricks. But you have in your head what his thing is. He wants to do right.
Yeah.
But in my instinct, things often went wrong.
Yeah.
But he's there, he's trying to do the right thing, even though it seldom goes according to plan.
Being confronted with this sort of blank slate of virtue was enough to kind of push you through the 3 years. Were there any fights that you had with Jonathan Turner, things that you won, things that you lost, battles that you regret having or that needed to actually be had, anything along those lines?
Interestingly, something that was resolved later on, you know, there was a big battle. John wanted to make the companions more interesting.
Yeah.
And while that's an admirable thing, I think he went around it the wrong way.
Yeah.
The way to make the companions more interesting is not just to give them certain traits, like Janet didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Turlough was trying to kill me.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily inherently make them. What you have to do is get them better written.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And that's what you've suffered from so much of the time, is the writing just wasn't up to it. And the irony, of course, is all the time that we were making the series, there were young kids out there watching this series, getting kind of inspired by it, who would later grow up, either write Doctor Who, be Doctor Who, or produce Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And they were all out there watching this series. So now I look at this modern, the new series since it came back, you know, with Russell T. Davis writing it originally, Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss, all of them, I think, brilliant writers.
Yeah.
Russell T. Davis, brilliant producer, now Stephen Moffat. So the show now has got a writing standard that I think is way above the writing standard we had, if I'm brutally honest with you.
Yeah.
And I'm deeply envious of that, the fact. And of course, they managed at a stroke to do what John had wanted to do, make the companions more interesting. And the way they do that was give them a character, you just write well for them, and there you have it. That's all you need to do. You know, there's an argument now which I heard put forward, which is kind of true, that really, certainly when it came back with Rose, was really almost Rose was the most important character in the series, not the Doctor.
Yeah.
You know, it was really Rose's story, the whole thing. But of course, in my day, and a big frustration for Janet and for Mark and for Sarah was that they were really just there to go, help, Doctor. Or,
what are you doing, Doctor?
Save me, Doctor. Yeah, yeah. What are we doing this for? Yeah. And it was very frustrating for them. I mean, Mark was hugely frustrated by the fact, because he'd been given this thing of trying to kill me all the time, the only thing we could do is lock him up every time a story came along. Otherwise, you couldn't explain why he wasn't trying to kill me.
In terms of maintaining the illusion, I have to mention the wobbly sets. I did notice when in my watching, in Modern Undead, there's a moment where the red door switch on the TARDIS console is actually so flimsy, and I noticed you actually like hold it up quite literally. And I was like, and you do it very subtly, and yeah. This is of course before DVD, before VHS,
yeah.
You do it very subtly so that nobody really notices. How much holding up of the set did the actors really have to do, and how did this really influence performance? We were talking about instinct. Well, it seems that one of the instincts was to hold the set together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I actually, you know, I used to love that. I still to this day. And I think it's because of doing Doctor Who. I love working under pressure.
Yeah.
I love that thing of when we get to a show. Nowadays, and I'm doing a scene, and people will go, "Okay, you've got this really big speech now. Do you want to do it now tonight? Because we've only got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Or do you want to leave it till tomorrow?" And I'll go, "No, let's do it now. Let's do it now." There's something about doing that stuff and holding the set together and speaking.
Yeah.
There's a famous. Scene, and I don't remember what the scene is now, but it's a famous time when we were so short of time in the studio, but literally the clock was ticking around to 10 o'clock and we were in the wrong set. The wrong set was lit.
Wow.
And the director said, just go on and say the lines.
Yeah.
Find the camera and say the line. This is like live television we're doing. No one had rehearsed it. The cameraman hadn't rehearsed it. So we walked on into a set we'd never rehearsed in. And I was just waiting for the lights to come on and say this. But there was something about that thing. I suppose it's a bit like being live on stage.
Yeah.
That kind of was so adrenaline pumping that actually you found what you were doing was far more instinctive and more exciting, and certainly in terms of you doing it. Now, how it came over, if it's entirely, could be entirely different. People could watch it and go, this looks terribly sloppy.
Yeah.
But in terms of actually doing it, I rather liked working with those things of, okay, I've got one hand here, I'm holding the set together, I can't do this, but I, you know, because it's like, I don't know, you're juggling things, and it's actually what we can be quite good at.
Do you think that there's something that's been lost as there's been a greater concern for getting things right with some of the more recent stuff? Because I know that the Doctor Who today is much different than the Doctor Who of yesteryear.
Mm.
And there is just longer hours, there's more takes, there's more concern for film. And not just Doctor Who, of course, other things as well.
Yeah.
You know, as an actor, do you think that some of the spontaneity of the old kind of almost near-life television thing has really been lost with...
That might be true. However, as I said to you, the main thing is what it is when you watch it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes as an actor, you can do a scene and you can think, I'm bloody brilliant in that scene.
Yeah.
And then you can see it back. Like, you can do 3 takes of something. This has happened to me so many times.
Yeah.
You do 3, maybe 4 takes of something and you think, okay, take 2 was really fantastic. The other were terrible.
Yeah.
Then you go along to what they call rushes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll sit there. And you cannot tell the difference between any of the 4 takes.
Yeah.
You just can't tell any difference at all. So what is happening is it's going on inside your head. And when it works inside your head, you're thinking, great, this is really good. But the next time you do it, although it may not be feeling so fantastic, what you're doing is you're duplicating it, and it looks actually absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
So I think it might be true that in those panic days, you got a bit more buzz and a bit more excitement. However, what we should be concerned about is what it looks like in the end. And,
yeah.
And very often, though what you think of being is marvelous and spontaneous, as I said, can look just sloppy.
Yeah. So my understanding is that for the roles after Who, you actually had to do roles in which you looked nothing like how you looked during Doctor Who, that you had to have mustaches or dyed hair or something along those lines. I mean, it seems to me, you know, obviously you have to keep up on the show, especially if you attend these conventions and so forth. How do you not get sick of Who? How do you not get sick of being burdened by this legacy? Or fans for
that? I was, I suppose, fortunate that I was known for something before Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So I don't feel that, and I went on fairly soon afterwards to things that weren't too Who connected. So I've never really felt resentment about Doctor Who, that in somehow it's the only thing that my career is about.
Yeah.
I just never have, and I can understand how that would come about. I mean, Tom, I think, took about 7 years to get over doing Doctor Who. He had, in fact, done stuff before Doctor Who, but he wasn't known by everybody, you know. So as far as the public were concerned, Tom was just the Doctor. And it took him a few years to get over that and go, okay, I'm now prepared to do stuff connected with Who, whether it's conventions or whatever. Yeah. But I was fortunate enough, and I do mean that, fortunate enough not to have that. I wasn't really affected by that. I was always doing, I did stuff before and I did stuff afterwards.
So when you choose roles, you do them in varying markets. On one hand, you've got Law and Order and Spamalot. On another hand, you have very small stage productions or things like that. And that allows you to mix things up so you aren't defined by any kind of fame or any kind of notoriety?
No, I don't feel that I am. I mean, of course, here, I am.
Yeah.
You're a king function here. Like this, you know, I can bring along. I usually bring along, when I used to come along to these things, you know, you bring along some photographs, and you'll bring along a bunch of Tristan photographs from All Creatures Great and Small, and then a bunch of, I did a series called Campion.
Yes.
I bring along some of it. And I've learned that at functions like this, people already aren't interested. Maybe the odd person would come up and go, have you got a Tristan photograph? But largely people, you know, a Doctor Who oriented, or, you know, so that's what they're interested in talking about and seeing me for. I've completely forgotten your question. What was the question?
I think it was really about doing variegated roles so that you actually don't become defined by notoriety.
I don't feel as if I'm defined by being the Doctor. And I'm very so. In other words, I've always felt very happy to revisit it because it's been quite nice. And usually, if I haven't done for some time, you know, and as you get older, your memory fades a bit. I get reminded by the fans about things.
Yeah.
I'll say to them, what was the story in which I did this? Now they always have the answer to hand.
They can answer your questions for you.
They can answer they can answer their own questions for themselves.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, Peter, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you. I appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure.
Right. Thanks.